Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining us as we continue to pour through the monster box of baseball cards. And while we started this program going through the memorable and, well, some not so memorable cards and players from the 1980s, we have graduated to 1990. And that's quite a big move here, not only because we've managed to continue to crank out podcasts, making our way to 1990, but also the hobby was just booming back then. And there were just way too many cards, but there were some really good cards and some not so good cards in 1990. And we'll take a look at each and every one of them, including 1990 Leaf, which in our previous podcast on 89 Tops, I said that 1990 Upper Deck would be the next one, and it will be. I inadvertently skipped over Leaf. They were new in 1990, so we will do 1990 Leaf in the next podcast coming up next Tuesday. Now, as for 1990 Upper Deck, we're going to take a look at that set in our random pull, card number 577, Matt Williams, a third baseman who was a power hitter to say the least. And as time has gone on, kind of has gotten lost in the shuffle. You know, not quite as much as his teammate Will Clark did. And I think Clark's career really did just kind of get lost in transition over the last 20, 25 years. Well, Williams has as well, and it's kind of odd that it's played out that way, because I remember, especially by 1990, certainly for a few years in the early 1990s, even the late 80s, once he made his transition to third base with the San Francisco Giants, this guy was one of the most feared third basemen in not only the National League, but the entire Major League Baseball. I mean, this guy could absolutely crush the ball, hit 43 home runs in 1994, and had just under 400 as a player in a pretty good career. But he kind of got lost in transition, and we'll talk a little bit about Matt Williams. We'll talk also about the 1990 Upper Deck set, which is a beauty, not quite as popular as the 89 Upper Deck set, but certainly kept the bar raised for sports cards in 1990. And here's the bigger kicker. You can get 1990 Upper Deck insanely cheap these days. Details on that in just a little bit. First, let's listen to you, as you have been talking quite a bit on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Please tell your friends about our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, because we're not only talking about our podcast and some of the players that we feature on the podcast, but we've got nice little conversations about the hobby, cards you're collecting now, cards you collected as a kid, going back and forth from one follower to another. So it's a nice little community here. So if you know somebody who collects now or collected once upon a time, tell them about Wax and Gum Stains and have them join us in the conversation. And don't forget to tell them about the Wax Ecstatic podcast, available Tuesdays and Fridays via Audio Boom and now on iTunes. And if your friend happens to have a few dollars in his or her pocket, we are still looking for a sponsor for the program. Follow us on Wax and Gum Stains. We'll direct message one another and try to make a deal happen between the two of us. Now, let's get to the comments from the last few days. A lot of people talking about our previous podcast, 89 Tops, and our random poll was Tim Raines, or as the card said, Rock Raines, one of the few times that a baseball card actually featured Tim Raines' nickname, which according to the back of this card, he actually preferred being called. But it was very unusual, because for most of his career, it was Tim Raines that was showing up on baseball cards, not Rock Raines. And the breaks at Watch the Breaks comments, I love any card where they call a guy by a nickname instead of his given name. Well, I do too. And we mentioned this in the podcast. You know, it's odd when you saw a card for Dennis Boyd, not Oil Can Boyd, or Jim Hunter, not Catfish Hunter. Well, this time it's the exact opposite. You were so used to seeing his birth name, Tim Raines, and not Rock Raines. So it was kind of unique that we happened to pull this card out of the 89 top stack. So I agree with you, even though this was a little bit of a reverse nickname card, if you will, well into Raines' career. This is one of the first cards that I recall where he was referred to as Rock Raines and not Tim Raines. Ben Adams, a much better set than 88 Tops. The font and swoop graphic make it great. Looks all-American. And you're right. First of all, 89 Tops, much better than 88 Tops. And even though 89 Tops was not a stellar set, I really like it. But even though it was not a stellar set or a bar-setting set in 1989 or even throughout the 1980s, you know, compared to 88, it had to get better from there. And Topps would actually make some very good sets from 89 through, I'd say, 93. You know, I really didn't collect in 94, but definitely over the next 4 or 5 years, they came up with some really quality cards. As for the font and swoop graphic, where the team name and the player name is, I likened it to the Late Night with David Letterman logo from the 1980s. Also, it's Dodgers script, basically. And it does look all-American. There is a very classic feel about that look, even though this is only, 27 years ago. Very cool look that still goes on to this day. You can design anything with that little swoosh tail underneath the name, underneath the text. And it just has a really cool, you know, all-star baseball kind of feel to it. Wax Pack 916, awesome podcast, easily top two sets of 89. As a kid, I collected Topps, didn't get into 89 Upper Deck until I became an adult. Same here, although I wasn't really an adult. I was a little older, but again, because of limited disposable income, shall we say, I only earned so much mowing the neighbor's yard. 89 Topps was a lot easier for me to get than Upper Deck. In fact, I didn't buy a box of Upper Deck until, I want to say, maybe 92. You know, by then I was 15, 16. I was starting to make some money doing lots of chores. So, yeah, I didn't have the disposable income to do it then. But Topps and Upper Deck, by far the top two sets that were released in 1989. And again, you know, I said Fleer and Donruss were pretty good. I have a soft side for Bowman, even though most collectors don't. Score's an absolute mess. But a lot of collectors, I think, will tell you that Upper Deck by far number one in 89. And I would think most of them would say that the 89 top set would be the second best one from that year. John Ragusa, Love 89 Tops, was a great looking card for the day. And while it was good for the day, like I said, it has survived. And that's a key word here. Even though it was massively overproduced, like pretty much every other set back then, it's managed to hold itself rather well all these years later. So it wasn't just a good looking set back in 1989. Still has a pretty good pull today, 27 years later. Now, while most of us like the 89 top set, not everybody likes it. Brian F., also known as Cheese Curd 76, ugh, so many of these terrible, terrible cards. Not a very big fan of those. He continues talking about Tim Raines. I read somewhere on here where Henderson, of course referring to Ricky Henderson, would have to steal 444 bases consecutively without being caught once to match Rock's career stolen base percentage. Cue the end of debate now. And of course, the debate is why Tim Raines isn't in the Baseball Hall of Fame. And like I said in the podcast, I think he is Hall of Fame worthy, but he's one of those players where a lot of other things are going to have to fall right. You know, it's got to be a lighter class of other candidates. And I really think 2017 is probably his best chance, because really, outside of Ivan Rodriguez, who you could argue isn't Hall of Fame worthy, I think he's kind of in that boat. But outside of Ivan Rodriguez, Manny Ramirez, you know, his PED use probably won't get him in on the first ballot, then it's pretty wide open and a great opportunity for Raines to get it. And considering he had 69% of the vote, I think there's a very good chance that he and Jeff Bagwell will get into the Hall of Fame, even though Bags was just a few percentage points short last year. And one last comment from our friends at Baseball Card Backs. I tweeted out before the podcast came out, I found a picture of just a random assortment of 89 Topps cards. And I didn't realize it at the time. They're actually 89 Topps traded cards. So you have John Kruk in this awful, awful painted Phillies logo. Yeah, they were still airbrushing back then. And, you know, you had a couple other guys who had changed teams. Well, Baseball Card Backs notes, selections from 89 Topps traded, I see. Evans inexplicably didn't have a card in the regular Topps set that year, referring to Darrell Evans, who did have a Topps traded card as a member of the Atlanta Braves. And the only reason why I can think that he didn't have a base set card was he was with the Braves in 1988. He was 41 years old, and of course, playing in the National League, you can't DH this guy. He still had some pop in his bat, so you'd put him in the lineup every now and then. And he was a free agent in the winter of 88. He wasn't re-signed by the Braves until, I want to say, like late December, so probably past the cutoff time that Topps had in terms of pulling together all of their players for the set. But also, I think the key is the people at Topps are going, okay, well, Darrell Evans re-signed with the Braves. Well, he's 42. He can only play third base or first base so many times. You can't DH him. Well, he's probably going to get cut from the team in spring training. Well, it turns out Darrell Evans played 107 games for the Braves in 1989. That's not only a testament to how good Darrell Evans was, he was able to put together one decent final season, but also how bad the Braves were to where you needed to have the 42-year-old third baseman just to keep things afloat. So Topps may have erred in not giving Darrell Evans his regular season base card, but they did give him the Topps traded card, and rightly so, considering he not only made the team out of camp, but was also able to help the team out a little bit, basically played about two-thirds of the season. And also a quick thanks to Shane Salmonson and Larry Robideau, I hope I'm pronouncing your names correctly there, for passing the word about Wax and Gum Stains along to friends, basically including us in a mass tweet telling friends who they should be following and, in our case, who you should be listening to. So we greatly appreciate it. Again, at Wax and Gum Stains is our Twitter feed. Certainly appreciate all comments, whether it's about our podcast, whether it's about the players we talk about in the podcast, or anything hobby-related. If you have any questions, put them up there. We'll be happy to answer them or post them for other people to answer. It's always entertaining when you can get a little conversation going. Now let's converse about the 1990 Upper Deck set. And our random selection here, number 577, Matt Williams. Then the star third baseman for the San Francisco Giants, just coming off of a World Series appearance against the Cross Bay rival Oakland Athletics. I love the 1990 Upper Deck card because Upper Deck could have stepped back a little bit after their big splashy debut in 1989, but they didn't. They kept the bar raised, not only in terms of quality, but also they started really changing the game here in 1990. I gave you a very lengthy podcast in 1989 Upper Deck a few weeks ago. Cecil Fielder was the random pull and spent over an hour talking about how Upper Deck, granted not being first with some of these innovations, actually 88 Score came up with a couple of things before 89 Upper Deck did, but they really changed the game with their card, with their packaging, with their inserts, with their pricing, and it took a while for the hobby to come around and adjust to it. Now, again, I think that it was an adjustment that was for good and for bad. For good, you have much better products being made. You didn't have any more 89 Scores being made in the hobby. You didn't have any more 82 Fleers being made. The bar was raised, and if somebody wanted to have a product that was sold and sold in large numbers, they had to make it as good or better than Upper Deck. And it did take a few years for everybody else to catch on, but the good news was everything was improved. The bad news, though, is that everyone tried to be Upper Deck. And if Upper Deck, you know, I likened it to the old General Motors lineup of cars, where Cadillac was the top model, and then you had Buick. And then you had Pontiac and Chevrolet and, you know, the cheaper cars, you know, a little further down the line. That was the pecking order. Depending on how much money you made, depending on what type of vehicle you needed, you could select anything from, a base price Chevrolet. If you had a lot of money and status, then you went out and got yourself a Cadillac. Well, everybody tried to be the Cadillac. And you can't all be the Cadillac. And when you have a market that's flooded with Cadillacs and the priciness of a Cadillac, then that eventually burns out some collectors. And that was something certainly by the mid-90s, a big factor in the decline in the hobby. So still in 1990, Upper Deck kept the bar raised. They introduced some very interesting innovations, which I'll get to in a second. And they continued to move the ball forward. And I have to commend Upper Deck for doing that because, like I said, they could have had a great premier edition and then just went, okay, this is good. Nope, they kept pushing the bar up, nudging it up little by little by little to where the competition had no choice. They had to up their game because Upper Deck was not going to back down. Now, while the design of the 1990 Upper Deck baseball card continues to raise the bar from what they put out in 89, one thing that Upper Deck did in 1990 that raised the bar in the entire hobby, the insert card. And not just any old insert card. We're talking about the limited edition autograph card. This was brand new. You know, you had inserts before, like special all-star cards or glossy cards, you know, things like that, or, you know, an all Fleer 1989 team card, stuff like that. But Upper Deck in 1990 was able to strike a deal with Reggie Jackson. They made a special 9-card insert set that basically went through every stage of Reggie's career. And then you had the special autographed versions of the cards. So this was the first chase card. That wasn't just like a rookie card or an error card. This was the first specifically produced chase card that was randomly inserted in packs. And that actually caused quite a bit of a buzz here because it's Reggie Jackson. So you not only had this really nice subset if you were able to collect all the cards, but if you were really lucky and you were able to get one of Reggie's autographs, I know back then, I mean, it was several hundred, if not thousands of dollars those cards were valued at. I think the numbers come down quite a bit because there were, I think, 2,500 autograph cards, something like that. But that was something that really started a domino effect. And again, much like everything else Upper Deck did, for better or for worse, for better in the sense that if you're a collector, you could actually get a Reggie Jackson autograph without ever having to go out and meet him. You know, that's a pretty good deal. You get this really nice autograph without having to actually go out and try to track this guy down. So that was the good side. But the bad side was after that, everybody else, you know, you started with, you know, gold cards, and then you started with refractors, and then we had different color this, and then we had autograph that, and then now we've got, you know, swaths of Babe Ruth's jockstrap being included in special cards. You know, it's gone a little overboard. It's kind of neat. You know, I've pulled from Topps Heritage. Oh, look, here's this one guy, and it's a shaving of his bat. You know, it's kind of neat. But I don't know if I could ever go, I need one more of this sleeve from this John Smoltz jersey. I have to find this card. And then you're buying cases and cases of cards for this one chase card. But it was unique in 1990, and it certainly did set a trend from then on. Not only were card companies expected to have good, high-quality cards, but also the chase card. You had to have another incentive thrown in there as to why you had to buy their product as opposed to somebody else's. Now, if you look at the front of the card, you have what Upper Deck was best known for. That, of course, the great photography, an action shot here of Williams about to field a ground ball. Looks like Rafi Ramirez, then with the Houston Astros right behind him trying to round third and head home. I'm assuming that's at third base. He might actually be playing shortstop there now that I think about it. So he could be fielding a ball at short. Yeah, it looks like there's a second baseman behind him. So this may be an older picture because really Williams was not completely third base until 89. So an older picture on file, but a great one. Very colorful one. Even made drab old Candlestick Park look pretty good here. And it's a picture that you normally don't see where the guy is about to make the play on the infield dirt. You've got the runner behind him. If there was ever an action shot, this was an action shot. Very well done. As I mentioned in the 89 Upper Deck podcast, you had the baselines moving around. 89 had the baseline along the right side, basically representing home to first. Well, this time, you're going from first to second. You've got the Upper Deck logo up in the upper right-hand corner. In the left-hand corner, in a very tiny base, you've got the player's position. Lower left-hand corner, the team logo, and I love team logos, and they pop really well on the Upper Deck cards. And even though there's a lot of color and action photography here, again, one of the things that people forget about with Upper Deck in the early days is that they weren't 100% picture on the front. There was still a very large white border, as you can see here. And in fact, the player's name is in the bottom of that frame. And I will say, though, even though there's a big white border and people forget that it wasn't all picture on the front of these Upper Deck cards, at least the early years, it looks kind of like a Polaroid picture, doesn't it? It's a really neat effect. And one of the reasons why collectors loved these cards, as you'll see as we go through the rest of the 1990 collections over the next few weeks, while there was some good photography, it wasn't Upper Deck. Now you flip the card over, a lot of the same things that you saw in 89 reappearing in 1990, where you have the player's name along the side of the card. You have the statistics there, you have the position, and you also have an action photo. In this case, the back of the card is horizontal, as we've got Williams sliding into, looks like he's sliding back into first base here. And right above that in the corner, it would be the upper left-hand corner if you were holding the card vertically, is the card number and that famous hologram, which Upper Deck was utilizing on the backs of their cards to try to combat counterfeit card collecting. Now, the issue, and I mentioned this in 89 Upper Deck, is, you know, now we're 26 years from 1990. Those holograms, their shelf life is not that good. So collectors are having a bear of a time collecting complete sets in gem mint condition because the hologram logo has aged and has flaked off a little bit all these years later. So that's probably the one bad thing about the 1990 Upper Deck set. Now, I mentioned that the cards can be had for mere pennies today. Even though Upper Deck was not as mass-produced as other sets in 1990, still, there was a lot of product that was made. And if you want a box of Upper Deck, you can get the low-number boxes. I couldn't believe this. I saw this before I started this podcast. You can get some low-number boxes for $12. $14. Now, it's without shipping, so once you add shipping, you're looking at probably about $22, you know, if you're ordering online. That's phenomenal. This is an outstanding set. You've got some really good rookie cards. You've got guys like Sammy Sosa. You also have Juan Gonzalez, John Olerud, Larry Walker, and of course, your usual collection of stars. Second-year card for Ken Griffey Jr. You've got it made here. This is an outstanding set, and if you want to put it together, it's not going to cost you that much, especially if you go the route of buying packs as opposed to, you know, just buying the complete factory set. Although if boxes are going for just $12, you could probably find a complete set for under $40. Now, just like the 89 set, this was an 800-card set, the 700-card base set, along with a 100-card update set, if you will, but that was all included afterwards. They would pick up the card numbering at 701 up until 800. And like I said, there weren't any knockout rookies in this set, but a good collection of players. And I don't know about you, but if I can buy a box for $12, I might just buy one and rip through them and just see what I can pull out of it, see what I can put together. Now, that's the only downside of the 800-card set is you would have to, if you're going through, wax boxes, you'd have to buy two or three boxes, and you'd have to make sure that there's a high number series box in there for you to complete that set. But this is a beauty of a set. If you've got $20 laying around, why not go online, find a box of these, and just rip into them and see what you can get? I think it would be a very good investment. Although the entire set investment, again, like every other card in 1990, you're not going to get much from it, so don't put too much into it. But this is one of those sets where if you put it together, or even if you don't have the complete set, you just have a nice collection of these cards, really nice cards. And I think you'll see even the common players, you'll see some interesting names come up as you're pulling these cards out, like Rafael Ramirez in his Rainbow Uni with the Houston Astros. Now, as for Matt Williams, also known as Matthew Derek Williams, Matt the Bat, who was an absolute fierce slugger with the San Francisco Giants for most of his career, also played in Cleveland briefly and Arizona, also known as the manager who preceded Dusty Baker in Washington. Well, he was a two-sport star. He was actually a star quarterback in high school. He played at Carson High School in Carson City, Nevada, was originally drafted by the New York Mets, did not sign with the team, so he re-entered the draft in 1986. Can you imagine the Mets? Sidebar here. Can you imagine the Mets, who have never, ever, 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 ever been able to find that star stud third baseman, if they were able to sign Matt Williams when they drafted him in 1983? Can you imagine that? I mean, that had he followed the same path where he's starting to make an impact in the major leagues, basically 88, 89, wow. You might have had a different story in Flushing Meadow, but that wasn't the case. He re-enters the draft in 1986. Giants pick him with the third overall pick, and it's not a very long road for him to get to the major leagues. Of course, the Giants in a little bit of a rebuilding mode in the mid-80s, and he comes up in 1987, appears in 84 games in his rookie season, but only bats 188. Despite 266 plate appearances. So a little bit of a rough start, But the Giants had nowhere else to go, so they bring him back in for smaller sample size in 88. He appears in 52 games, hits 205 in 89, the year that they get to the World Series, only appearing in 84 games, and also only hitting, how many home runs did he hit there? Or what was his batting average? 202. But he's starting to hit home runs here on a pretty frenetic pace, getting 18 home runs. So this guy, he's starting to figure out how to hit the ball in the major leagues, and he makes a very important shift as they move him from shortstop to third base. Now, as a shortstop, he was a decent shortstop, career fielding percentage of 970. He had a worse career fielding percentage, 963 at third base, but the Giants needed to fill that need, and then you're also getting your more typical baseball lineup of having power from the catcher out down the lines, left and right field, and then defense up the middle. So they were willing to trade those few percentage points defensively for a guy who could just absolutely smack the crap out of a ball. And starting in 1990, he did just that. He was an all-star in 1990, hit 33 home runs, 122 RBI, and his batting average finally surfaces to a decent level. He hit 277 that season. He was sixth in MVP voting and a Silver Slugger. And then everything comes together in 1991. Not only is he just pounding the ball, hitting 268 and 34 home runs, but he was a Gold Glove winner as well. And as his career continued in San Francisco, he was an all-star. He was a Silver Slugger. He was a Gold Glove winner twice, 1993 and 94. And he was the runner-up in the National League MVP voting in 1994. But all good things must come to an end, and he was moved to Cleveland. People forget Matt Williams did play in Cleveland for a little bit of a time. After the 1996 season, he was traded for a player to be named later, Jeff Kent, Julian Taveras, and Jose Vizcaino, or as Vin Scully would say, Jose Vizcaino. So the Cleveland Indians sent Joe Roa back to San Francisco. By the way, the Giants also owed the Indians a player to be named later. That was Trent Hubbard. So a very complicated trade there. Williams would spend just one season, 1997, with Cleveland. It was a productive season overall, though, appearing in 151 games, batted 263, also hit 32 home runs his first time, and it would turn out to be only time as a member of an American League team. And the Indians also had a pretty decent run in 1997, made it all the way to the World Series, of course, losing to the Marlins in seven games. Sorry, Indians fans, got to bring up more misery to you. But he was an absolute stud in the World Series, batted 385 in that series, a seven-game series loss to the Marlins. Now, after the 97 season ends, the Indians start tweaking things more. They trade him to the new Arizona Diamondbacks. The Indians, in return, get Travis Fryman, Tom Martin, and cash. So, via trade, Williams becomes an original member of the Arizona Diamondbacks, and he is a part of that 2001 World Series team. He had some great seasons in Arizona, most notably 1999, an all-star season, his lone all-star season with the Diamondbacks, where he hit 35 home runs and batted 303. As that was just the third time in his career he topped 300 at the plate. Not bad for a guy his rookie season, hitting 188 despite appearing in almost half the games that season. Now, his career started winding down. Injuries started taking their toll, and he was released by the Diamondbacks after the 2003 season. Got into broadcasting a little bit, got into coaching as well. In fact, was a coach in Arizona just a few seasons ago, and then hired by the Washington Nationals heading into the 2014 season. He was the National League Manager of the Year, but in the world of managing any sports team, not just baseball, it's all about what have you done for me lately. The Nationals were not able to do very well in 2015. In fact, a lot of people thought that they were a World Series contender. They totally missed the playoffs, and his overall career record as manager of the Washington Nationals reads 179 wins, 145 losses. More importantly, though, one win, three losses in the playoffs. Now, I don't want to spend too much time talking about the Hall of Fame. We did quite a bit of that with Tim Raines, but unfortunately, it doesn't look like Williams, despite having some very decent career numbers, will make it to the Hall of Fame for a number of reasons. Like I said, decent career numbers. He hit .268. He had 378 home runs. He had 1,878 base hits throughout his career. He was a World Series champion, as I mentioned, in 2001. And, you know, had a very good career. He was a five-time All-Star, like I said, a runner-up for MVP. But you look at the overall numbers, and he is definitely a case of a guy who would really need a lot of things to go in his favor to get into the Hall of Fame. Very good career, but I don't think Hall of Fame worthy. It does just fall just shy, I think, of you know, that mark. I think you have to have 2,000 hits, 400 home runs. He would need a little more, but I think injuries late in his career really robbed him of that opportunity. Now, another thing that's causing people to hold back from electing him into the Baseball Hall of Fame, you guessed it, steroid allegations. A lot of stories about 10 years ago that he purchased human growth hormone, steroids, a whole other cocktail of drugs from a clinic back in 2002. Now, he told the paper that was reporting this would be the San Francisco Chronicle, well, he had a good reason to use HGH. A doctor told him, use it to help treat an ankle injury that he had in 2002. And this was one of the cases about steroids and performance-enhancing drugs. Sure, you had big-name stars like Jose Canseco and, allegedly, Barry Bonds, Mark McGwire, you know, Alex Rodriguez has admitted to it. Sure, some of the big names, but typically what you saw in the heyday of steroid use, and again, this is about 10, 15 years ago, the people who used it most, there were two types. There were one who were veterans just trying to hang in there, and that would be the case of Matt Williams. And the other was guys who were good but not great enough to make the leap from minor league baseball to major league baseball, and especially foreign-born players, players coming from countries like Puerto Rico or the Dominican Republic or Cuba, who had, you know, a rough life growing up. Their out to prosperity was playing professional ball, and if they could just make it to the major league level, they would hit big-time money, keep it for themselves, give some to family. So you would see a lot of guys who were AAA players or kind of platoon players, bench players, who you'd only see 20, 30 times a season. Those were the guys who were allegedly juicing, and those were the guys that Major League Baseball typically caught. And that's why I remember back in the day, people would go, oh, yeah, well, they're not going to catch Barry Bonds, but they caught Biff Spidzu, the backup, you know, bullpen catcher for this team. These were the guys that weren't blessed with as much talent as some of the other guys in Major League Baseball. So they would try to get some advantage to get into the major leagues and stay there. So it wasn't just guys trying to get in. It was guys trying to stay in, which would have been the case of Matt Williams. Now, he was also named in the Mitchell report, so there's a lot of allegations that he did use it. And like I said, he said that a doctor told him to use it, which was bad advice. The one time he was eligible for the Hall of Fame vote back in 2009, he received a whopping 1.3% of the vote, and he was dropped off the ballot ever since then. So not Hall of Fame worthy in terms of stats. Certainly the allegations are not going to help him. But it'll be interesting to see where Matt Williams ends up, because we've seen, especially with the Washington Nationals, even under Dusty Baker, while the Nationals have been a good team, that's the team that hasn't quite gotten over the hump just yet. You've got an interesting collection of personalities on that team. Time will only tell. Was it really Matt Williams' fault for not being able to get this team to come together and actually win a World Series, or is it just the collection of players that they have? And oh, by the way, the National League and even the National League East can be a tough place to play at times. So it'll be interesting to see where Matt Williams ends up. But we certainly remember him as a hell of a third baseman, not only for San Francisco, but as I said later, with Cleveland for 1 year, and also for Arizona for the very beginning of the Diamondbacks' existence. And it is a little unfortunate that his career has kind of faded out of the general view. You know, like I said, his teammate in San Francisco, Will Clark, very similar. As time has gone on, people have kind of forgotten how big of a threat this guy was, and he really was an impressive player. And as I pointed out, looking through some of his stats, this guy was not a shoo-in when he first came up to the major leagues. Could barely hit .200, didn't hit the ball out of the park that much, was an okay shortstop defensively. Well, he makes the move to third. He starts learning how to hit well in the major leagues. And by the mid-90s, this guy was an absolute stud. So kudos to him for figuring it out. And also to the Giants, too, for not giving up on this first-round pick very early on. You'll see some teams do that. If you don't get it by year two, you're on the move. He was able to stay with the Giants for 11 seasons from 1986 through the end of the 1996 season. All right, so there's our look at 1990 Upper Deck and Matt Williams. If you have any thoughts or comments about either of those topics, feel free to chime in again at our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. You're always welcome to talk about what you see there and what you're seeing in the hobby as well at any time. And we will be talking about a new entry into the card hobby world from 1990, Leaf, a company that had been around a very long time and had actually been doing Canadian baseball cards for a while. But the first appearance of a United States version of Leaf baseball cards, something completely different from what they were doing before, that'll be our topic, and we'll have a random poll for you as well. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much once again for listening to Wax Ecstatic.